Political extremist Lyndon LaRouche ran for president 3 consecutive times, beginning in 1976. Many people dismissed him as a paranoid kook. His announced objective was to build a grand coalition to rid American politics of the enemy within, the leftists, liberals, environmentalists, and Zionists. In his world of conspiracy theories, Henry Kissinger was a Soviet spy, and Queen Elizabeth the head of an international drug ring. But Dennis King says it's dangerous to dismiss LaRouche as a kook. According to King, LaRouche ran the best organized and wealthiest neo-fascist operation of the 1980s, and he made extraordinary inroads into American politics, surpassing the achievements of any other extremist movement in recent American history. Dennis King has been following the LaRouche story for 20 years and has been writing about him for 10. King's work has been published in The New Republic, The Wall Street Journal, and the New York City weekly Our Town. King has written a new book called Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. In January, LaRouche was sentenced to 15 years in prison for scheming to defraud the IRS and deliberately defaulting on more than $30 million in loans from supporters. LaRouche is now behind bars, so I asked Dennis King why he thinks it's still important to look into the story of LaRouche.
Because Lyndon LaRouche has proved something of vital importance to the American people, and that is our extreme vulnerability to manipulation and infiltration and influence by a cleverly disguised right-wing extremist movement. Now, LaRouche never wore a swastika on his arm, and he never made a Sieg Heil salute, and I don't think he ever dressed up in jackboots or in a Ku Klux Klan robe. His politics were the same, but he did disguise them. And based on that, he was able to make, in the 1980s, almost unbelievable inroads into American public life. He and his followers raised over $200 million from the American public. They ran thousands of candidates for public office, more candidates than any extremist group in American history. These candidates received millions of votes, and in fact, they won major primaries in Illinois in 1986, which upset the Democratic Party very much. In fact, they have also achieved primary victories in scores of races for Congress and state legislature around the country. And while doing all of this, they managed in the early 1980s to gain entree to the highest levels of the Reagan administration, to top officials of the National Security Council, and to major CIA officials, to people in the Pentagon, and they also formed close ties to high levels of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the largest union in America, and the most powerful union in America. Most of this was never reported in the daily press, which tended to depict LaRouche as some kind of kook who merely believes that the Queen of England pushes drugs. And by portraying him as simply a kook, they diverted people's attention away from the hard facts of the matter, which was that LaRouche had gained incredible influence in our society and had reached out and formed alliances of convenience and also ideological alliances with a wide variety of people on both the right and, in some cases, on the left.
How did you first become aware of Lyndon LaRouche?
I became aware of him in 1968 during the Columbia University student strike when LaRouche was giving a seminar in a Columbia fraternity house. And I went to it, and he seemed to be a kind of a middle-aged guru who was looking for young followers. He was tremendously erudite. But curiously, at that time, he had a bushy beard and was dressed kind of like almost like a hippie, in sharp contrast to the way he dresses today with his three-piece business suits and Texas Stetson hat and designer glasses.
LaRouche is an extremist who started out on the far left and ended up on the far right, but there was always some kind of mixing of the two extremes in his rhetoric. Let's start off with where he started on the far left. He started off in what, a Trotskyite splinter group of SDS?
Well, actually, LaRouche joined the Socialist Workers' Party, which is the main Trotskyist party in the United States, in 1948, and he was a member of it until 1965. At that time, he split away and soon formed his own organization inside SDS. that is inside the Students for Democratic Society. And that group came to be known as the National Caucus of Labor Committees. In the early 1970s, it was avowedly a communist organization committed to making a socialist revolution in the United States. But LaRouche was already speculating with fascist-style ideas. And in the middle 1970s, over a period of about 4 years, he gradually nudged his followers from the far left to all the way over to the farthest most right, where he began to advocate a kind of cryptic version of neo-Nazism, complete with calls for the rounding up of the Jews and total war against the Soviet Union, bacteriological and chemical warfare to wipe out the so-called inferior species, and all kinds of really bizarre things that, you know, you would have heard in Nazi Germany.
You describe the National Caucus of Labor Committees, this group that he founded,
yes,
as a political group that used the tactics of religious cults to attract people and to keep them.
That's true. LaRouche could never have gotten away with transforming his left-wing followers into rightists if he had not first put them through some very rigorous psychological conditioning sessions. He called this ego stripping. And they would get people in a room and concentrate on one person at a time, breaking them down by just picking their personality apart. Some people got disgusted with this and quit his organization. But those who were willing to stick it out, they were gradually remolded. Their entire thinking was remolded to the point they were willing to accept just about anything LaRouche told them. Now, you said that, you know, he ended up with a kind of mixed ideology, but I would say that's not, strictly speaking, true, that he began on the left and he moved to the far right, and today I would define LaRouche as being really a fascist in the classic sense of that word. I mean, he embodies all of the ideas that you found in Nazi Germany and in Mussolini's Italy. Sometimes he has rephrased the ideas a little bit, but basically it's the same ideas and the same game plan, the drive to the East. I mean, he goes over to West Germany and he will give speeches before German military officers and defense contractors. He talks to them about, you know, literally developing super weapons through which Germany can rise again and dominate the planet. So he's trying to present himself really as being the new Hitler.
Back when he was starting off on the left, and as you described, using the tactics of cult groups to draw and keep people, he was using violence to break up the meetings of the groups that he saw as the opposition groups. Would you explain a little bit what his tactics were there?
Well, at that time, he saw the Communist Party USA as being the main organization on the far left, and that if he wanted to gain hegemony on the left, then he would have to discredit the Communist Party and essentially drive it out of business. And he decided the best way to do that would be to launch a campaign of physical terror against them in hopes that they would just collapse. Now, of course, this did not happen because the Communist Party and other left-wing groups in turn developed defense squads, and also local police came in and started arresting LaRouche's followers. But he accomplished something very important through this, and that is that he got his followers to essentially draw a line between themselves and the rest of the left, where they defined the rest of the left as being evil social fascist counter-revolutionaries. That's what they called them at the time, whereas the NCLC was the only pure organization, the only trustworthy organization. So once they had drawn this line between themselves and the rest of the left, it was relatively easy for LaRouche to say to them, hey, the entire left is no good, let's move over to the right.
My guest is Dennis King, and he's written a new book called Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. You explained a little bit about how LaRouche managed to move his followers from the left to the right because they followed him as they'd follow a cult group leader. Was it easy for him to get any credibility once he shifted to the far right?
It was
credibility among people on the far right.
It ended up being very simple for him. I mean, as early as 1976, LaRouche approached top officials of the Republican Party and suggested that they join with his organization in a challenge of Jimmy Carter's election, because, as you will remember, Carter won by a very narrow majority in some states. And the LaRoucheans actually gained the ear of, the head of the Republican National Committee, and they gained the ear of Senator Vandenjagt, who was the head of the Republican caucus in Congress, and they gained the ear of people very close to Gerald Ford. And they had Republicans around the country donating money to this effort to challenge Jimmy Carter's election. And in fact, the major newspapers at the time pointed out how this odd alliance had come about between the Republicans and the LaRouche's organization. And after that, they continued to cultivate conservatives, and much of the money that LaRouche raised over the following 10 years, these incredible sums of money, came from conservatives, came from supporters of Ronald Reagan. Now, many of these people were misled by LaRouche because he exaggerated the degree to which he was in agreement with Ronald Reagan. In fact, I would say LaRouche was not really in agreement with Ronald Reagan on anything at all. He just pretended to be. But nevertheless, by disguising himself as a conservative, he was able to raise large amounts of money, and there were many, many naive conservatives out there who just simply would not listen to people in the conservative movement who repeatedly warned them. To give you examples, the National Review in 1979 did an excellent front page article about LaRouche's ties to the Ku Klux Klan, and and they warned conservatives against him, but people didn't listen. Then General Danny Graham, the head of High Frontiers, which is a group that lobbies for Star Wars, he also spoke out repeatedly warning people in the defense community to beware of LaRouche, but many people didn't listen, and so LaRouche was able to gain a remarkable series of ties with the important defense scientists and with people around the Pentagon. And he actually emerged as kind of a leading publicist for Star Wars during the early 1980s.
Well, he set up something called the Fusion Energy Foundation, which you describe as his front group for, well, you describe it as basically the science and technology division of the NCLC. Why was he so, why did he become such an advocate of beam weapons?
Well, I think the reason for this is LaRouche's stated that his long-range goal is to establish the rule of a what he calls the super race of golden souls over the earth. And the golden souls he envisions as being his own followers, and essentially kind of like the second generation of his followers who will raise his ideology to the nth degree of effectiveness and power. But he believes that there's an evil oligarchy that today dominates the earth. And these oligarchs, when he gets down to describing them in detail, almost always have Jewish names and have a special connection to the Rothschild family and the State of Israel and the Anti-Defamation League. So it's very clear he's talking about the Jews. But as LaRouche sees it, people with his fascist ideology have to come to power in the major countries of the West, unify the West, and then prepare it for total war. And he has a whole complicated economic theory of how you prepare for total war through throwing trillions of dollars into huge centralized defense research projects. And LaRouche's idea was that America would develop weapons so powerful that they, of course, would share with the Germans, that they would be able to just totally wipe out the Soviet Union and anybody else who might stand in the way of LaRouche's vision of this unified planet under one government.
LaRouche followers used to have tables of literature advocating beam weapons. In airports is where they'd set up with the literature. Did you ever run into them at airports?
Oh, many, many times. I mean, I would imagine there's tens of millions of Americans have seen their signs at airports. And
what would the signs say?
Well, they would, back in the middle of 1970s, they would support nuclear power. Then they were promoting fusion energy with the belief the government should pour billions of dollars into a crash program to develop fusion energy. And incidentally, on that point, they may very well have been right. And that's one of the things that makes LaRouche so dangerous, is that on many individual issues, he comes up with ideas that make sense. But then they dropped fusion energy and went into promoting beam weapons around 1981. And 2 years later, of course, Ronald Reagan announced suddenly out of the blue and surprising the entire press corps that the U.S. was going to embark upon a program of developing precisely these beam weapons. Curiously, the LaRouchians knew months ahead of time that Reagan was going to make the speech, because they were in close contact with the scientists and policymakers involved in that decision.
I want to talk with you more about Lyndon LaRouche, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Dennis King, the author of the new book, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dennis King, and for the past 20 years, he's been following Lyndon LaRouche's attempts to build a political base in this country. King has put together his findings in the new book, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. I think one of the things that frightens you most about LaRouche is the inroads that he made into the electoral system in the United States. It was in the mid-70s that he started running election campaigns. He started off as a Republican, then switched to the Democratic Party. Would you explain the logic behind his change?
Well, actually, he didn't start off as a Republican. He started off with his own independent electoral party called the U.S. Labor Party. Then in 1979, he was running for president, and he realized that if he wanted to gain a large vote and start really collecting a lot of money for his campaign from conservatives down in Texas, he would need to enter one of the major parties, because only in the major party primaries can a maverick really have any chance of gaining a major vote. Now, LaRouche could have gone into the Republican Party, but there was already an organized right wing within the Republican Party, and if he had gone in there, he would have been seen as an interloper and would have been literally driven out. But very cleverly, LaRouche chose the Democratic Party, because that is the party where there was no organized right wing. In other words, it was a vacuum. He could move in and immediately set himself up as a counterpole to the liberal party leadership. And also, the Democratic Party does have in its grassroots base, you know, a large number of conservative-minded people. And they tend to be those conservatives of lower income, farmers, blue-collar workers. They stay in the Democratic Party because they agree with its social programs, even though on all other issues they are would probably feel more comfortable in the Republican Party. But LaRouche decided that he would try and become the new George Wallace to appeal to these people. He would appeal to the what he called the forgotten majority of the Democratic Party. So he moved into the party in the early in 1979, and in after the primaries in 1980, in which he gained almost 200,000 votes, he set up an organization for permanent long-range infiltration of the Democratic Party. Now, earlier on the show, I was sort of critical of the Republicans, but I want to balance that, because I think that the Democrats have behaved with equal foolishness in their dealings with Lyndon LaRouche down the years, because at any time they could have drawn a line and thrown LaRouche out of the Democratic Party. Instead, they chose to ignore him. And in 1982, LaRouche had a candidate who ran for governor of Pennsylvania, came in second out of four candidates with 19% of the vote. I mean, that was a clear warning sign that LaRouche was up to something, that he was mining voter discontent. In 1983, his people ran over 500 candidates. And in 1984, they ran over 2,000 candidates and actually won their first congressional primary. Now, the warning signs were there, but the Democratic Party simply would not do anything about it. They tried to rationalize it away. No matter how many candidates LaRouche ran, their answer was, oh, LaRouche is just a kook. We have nothing to worry about.
You say that Lyndon LaRouche learned to exploit the weaknesses of the two-party system.
That's true.
In the United States. What do you mean by that?
The basic weakness he exploits is that both parties will allow anybody to walk in and declare himself a Democrat or Republican and, you know, sign up, register as a party member without having to adhere to any kind of philosophical principles whatsoever. And thus David Duke, who is a Nazi, can call himself a Republican, and LaRouche, who is a Nazi, can call himself a Democrat. And here in Manhattan, the Communist Workers' Party, who are followers of Pol Pot, can call themselves Democrats. And it's like, I mean, there's no mechanism at the present time for keeping extremists out of the major party primaries. Now, listen, I support the civil liberties of these people, even though I don't like them. I believe that Lyndon LaRouche and David Duke and the Communist Workers' Party have the constitutional right to run for public office, and they have the right to publish literature. They have the right to function, you know, as citizens of a free society. But the Democratic and Republican parties are private organizations. These are not government organizations, and they have a right and a duty to draw a line someplace and to say, hey, you're not one of us. You cannot run in our primary. If you want to run, go form your own party and have your own party primary. I think that's a perfectly reasonable request, and I think it's high time that both the Democrats and the Republicans made up their minds to enforce, you know, some kind of reasonable standard of membership.
I've noticed that when you speak of LaRouche or his organization, you use the present tense, in spite of the fact that LaRouche is behind bars now.
Well, Adolf Hitler went to prison for the Munich Beer Hall Putsch, and it didn't put his Nazi party out of business. Reverend Moon went to jail, like LaRouche, for income tax evasion, and it didn't put the Unification Church out of business. In fact, the Unification Church is stronger than ever. Virtually the entire leadership of Scientology went to jail a few years ago for dirty tricks against the government, stealing government files and so on, and yet Scientology is more popular than ever today. So just taking examples there, both from the history of political extremism and from the history of cultism, I don't see that you can say that the jailing of a leader is going to automatically lead to the demise of one of these movements. LaRouche has created an ideology. He's created a body of strategy and tactics, which are very impressive. And this stuff has a life of its own. He's created an organization which is composed of members who, many of whom, are very, very committed. And just because he's in jail, these people are not suddenly going to walk away from the ideology that they have accepted for the past 20 years of their lives. So I think it's quite possible that his organization will continue to be an important player on the far right in this country. And already you can see by the victory of David Duke for the state legislature in Louisiana that LaRouche's strategy and tactics has spread beyond the ranks of his own organization into the larger world of American white supremacy.
And how do you see David Duke as being an extension of LaRouchean
because
politics?
Duke and the other traditional white supremacists, after LaRouche's 1986 victories, began to have meetings to discuss adopting LaRouche's strategy. And in fact, the premier ideologue of white supremacy, Bob Miles, wrote an article in his newsletter in which he praised LaRouche for, you know, his political raiders had struck a blow against Zionism, and he said, "Well done, Lyndon, well done." And groups that monitor the far right, like the Center for Democratic Renewal in Atlanta, have been publishing articles for 3 years now warning that the traditional white supremacists were going to adopt LaRouche's tactic, that is one of infiltrating the major parties, and doing it in a sort of on three levels at once. In other words, infiltrate the Democrats, but also infiltrate the Republicans, which LaRouche has done to a certain extent, and also run independent candidates when that seems to be the best tactic. So, and LaRouche has also done that, because when he lost the Democratic primaries in 84 and 88, he then ran as an independent on both occasions. So the David Duke forces adopted that policy, and Duke ran in the Democratic primaries for president in 88, and when he did not do very well there, he simply switched to the Republican Party and ran for the state legislature in Louisiana. And he disguised his Nazism and started to call himself an environmentalist. environmentalist and simply a promoter of traditional conservative values, and he carefully did not put on any bed sheets during the campaign. And the result of that was that he won, even though both Ronald Reagan and George Bush called on the voters of that district to vote against David Duke. Nevertheless, he won, and that showed the power of the strategy and tactics that LaRouche has devised. In other words, it's a strategy of not coming out in the open and slapping the public in the face with your extremist politics, but instead disguising that politics like a subtle virus disguises itself. And sort of you get into the middle of the political process, and then you gradually begin to poison it and to spread more and more extremist ideas and find more and more people who are opportunist enough to make a pact with the devil, so to speak. And that's the way an extremist movement always grows. A very great woman named Hannah Arendt wrote the book Origins of Totalitarianism, in which she described this process after having studied the history of Bolshevism and Nazism and Mussolini's fascism, all three. And I think that everything Lyndon LaRouche does, and every bizarre way in which the political structure in this country has reacted to him, all of that can be found in Hannah Arendt's book. In other words, there's nothing really new under the sun here. It's LaRouche is mining an old tradition.
You've been following LaRouche for about 20 years and writing about him for around 10. Have you ever been harassed by LaRouche's followers?
Absolutely. When I first published articles about them in the newspaper Our Town in 1979, the LaRoucheans immediately began putting out smear leaflets against myself and the publisher of Our Town. They broke into the offices of Our Town. They sent imposters around to gather information. They went to the advertisers of Our Town and threatened them that they would be sued if they didn't drop their advertising. And then they sued me, and I was in court with them for over a year, and eventually they dropped the suit, but then they sued me again in 1984 when I cooperated with NBC in a television show on LaRouche. And in between, I was subjected to death threats. Members of my family were harassed. Personal friends of mine were harassed. Smear leaflets about me were put under the doors in the building where I lived. And it was sort of like guerrilla warfare. You know, you would never know when they were going to strike again. But I guess a journalist who chooses to write about nasty people has to expect that kind of thing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Dennis King's new book, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism, is published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.